Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to HR Latte, your first cup of talent management lit to perfection.
Wow, welcome to HR Latte. This is Rayanne Thorne. I am very excited to be here today and to have my guest, Mr. Torin Ellis, on the show as I kick off my series, Diversity in the Workplace. Torin is here as my guest to discuss racial bias, and I'm going to ask some questions that may seem simplistic, but are questions that I've never asked anyone, and I just assume that I'm thinking or doing right. And before I introduce Torin, and Torin is outside, if you hear outside noises, I believe he's outside enjoying the beautiful morning in Baltimore, and so that adds an interesting context to our conversation, to the fact that Torin is in Baltimore at this time. Before we kick off, I wanted to share a quote with you from a very wise and witty gentleman, Benjamin Franklin, who said, "Quarrels never could last long if on one side only lay the wrong." So with that, I want to welcome Torin. Thank you, Torin, for joining me today.
You know, I absolutely appreciate you giving me a chance to kick off this month-long series with you and your audience. I thank you again for trusting my voice, and I'm happy to be with you.
Well, Torin, you and I met, it's probably been about 2 years via online, and have had several conversations over the phone and then met through the Lavoie Entertainment docufilm projects. I also invited you to join me in Baltimore when we had an event at the Enoch Pratt Library. The country may be more familiar with the library now after the events of the last 2 weeks that have taken place in Baltimore. And what a beautiful building it is, and I was glad to read and see that there was no damage and that the library continues to support the community by bringing young people in and offering them a place of refuge, if you will, during a really stressful and time full of strife for your city. So before we get into our conversation, I want to give you an opportunity, Torin, to tell us about yourself and about the Torin Ellis brand.
So I'm not sure where to start, but how about we go with, I backed into recruiting in 1998 after running a successful sales team for MCI Communications. When I left MCI Communications in 1998, I had one of the top performing sales teams in the entire country. More importantly, I had one of the more tenured sales teams. And what that shared or showed me was that if I could hire individuals for MCI, I could do it and do it for myself, then I could probably do it for other organizations. And so literally I backed into this game of recruitment that I absolutely am fond of today. And so 17 years later, here we are, and the brand today focuses on diversity recruiting strategies, helping organizations identify and include diversity in their search engagements. It's not exclusive, it's just that we try to make sure that diversity is included. We try to help organizations establish the types of search strategies that will reveal these candidates for them and for their radar. And ultimately, it comes down to our doing a good job of putting good people in good organizations to build better companies.
Great. I want to thank you once again for joining me today, but also to lay down some parameters for our conversation. I am a white girl who lives in South Orange County, California. I live in Laguna Beach. I have grown up in California. I spent some time, 10 years, in the Midwest, living just outside of Chicago in a small town, farming town in northwest Indiana, about 60 miles outside of Chicago. And I can tell you this, as a white girl, and I have no problem with anybody calling me white. I actually prefer white over Caucasian. I know that everybody has their preference, that I was raised in a home where I never heard my parents say a bad thing about anyone of any other race. My father was a traveling salesman, and his stories were filled with love and joy always of the different people that he met on our travels. Torin, I want to ask you a question that maybe a person like me wouldn't normally ask, and we talked about this before the show, about the right words to use when referencing somebody of color, and I don't even know if that's the right way to say it, somebody of color, somebody that's different than me. I prefer human being, but you know, we live in a world where we are identified by how we look, how we dress, what we do, and so is it okay to call an African-American or an American who is black, to call them black? Or to call, when, what is the preferred terminology? You as a black man, what is the preferred terminology? Torin? Uh-oh, did I upset Torin? I lost him. Well, hopefully he'll be able to call back in. He was walking around outside, and there he is. Hey, Torin, you didn't hang up on me, did you?
No, I actually hit a rough spot, and I apologize. So I have pulled over, and we're going to try to prevent that from happening again.
That would be great.
Right
that
to your question.
Great.
No worries.
Thank
Let me get
so
right
much.
To your question. So you asked in reference to how one likes to be referred.
Right.
You said I grew up in the Midwest as well. I was born in South Florida down in Broward County. I moved to Toledo, Ohio, because that's where my father was from. We moved to Columbus, Ohio. I ultimately lived in that. Well, and when I tell that,
Torin,
you're
breaking up a little bit. Can you move to another location? I don't want to lose your answer.
Oh, I'm sorry. So can you hear me now? Is that better?
Yes, that's good. That's good.
Yeah. Yeah, so they'll smile when I tell them that I'm from Davenport, Iowa. The point I'm making with you is that I, too, grew up in the Midwest, and I don't think that it's fair for me to do an interview with you or anyone else and try to categorize how people like to be referred. It depends on the context of the conversation, and if you decide that you wish to say African-American and you and I are having that conversation, I can probably go with that. If you say the word black, sometimes that can be a bit offensive. Again, it really depends on the context of the conversation. And so I try to use that as my sensitivity meter. When I'm referring to people, when I'm conversing with other people, that's the rule that I live by. Does that make sense?
Right. So we just need to be aware. It's not like we have to start every conversation with, hey, if I reference a black person, how would you like me to call them? I think we just need to be sensitive and understanding.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely. You
Great.
Just need to be sensitive. Yeah, just, you know, be sensitive and, you know, just kind of look at body language and all those other good things. But I think most people that operate in the circles that we operate in, they carry that level of sensitivity. And so, yeah, I don't necessarily have a problem with a person saying African-American or black, but, you know, it really depends.
So let's ask, I'm going to ask about Baltimore. How are things today in Baltimore?
It's just like it was two Fridays ago.
Okay.
And literally, you know, that one day of riot that made national news and put my city on the map, and now having it to be the most talked about city over the last 7 to 10 days, it really was that. It was that one day of rioting. Everything else up until that point was all peaceful protests. And we are, for the most part, back to normalcy in that regard, where we are exhibiting peaceful protests. And day in and day out, they will continue to do that. As it relates to the community in which all of this activity happened, they're still having, you know, bits and pieces of heated, you know, scenarios, if you will. But in large part, people are protesting and trying to make sure that they bring about change in the city that we all love.
Okay. And I had an opportunity to visit there. And, drive through the city. I was there for 3 or 4 days and visited some wonderful locations and just spoke to people who were there trying to help the economy. Individuals that worked at job centers, individuals that taught new skills, individuals that worked at Catholic charities and opened their doors to job seekers or folks like my team when we were there and trying to say, we can help you. Let us come into your city and help you. And it was very refreshing to be welcomed with, I'm just going to call it love. There was a lot of love and respect. And I was heartsick when I saw what happened in Baltimore. And so I'm really happy to hear that things have leveled off and that there's a feeling of normalcy. When we talk about diversity, so when we kick off this subject, this topic, I've heard you say that you want a full-blown economy, and included in that economy is diversity in the workforce. And it cannot come from a hiring department that has to fill numbers, that has a specific quota to fill when they're hiring, as in regards to having a diverse workforce. It needs to come from an organization and leadership within that organization that recognize the positive change that having a diverse workforce can have on the organization, so that it is a true change within or a true embracing of what it is meant by a full-blown economy. So can you help me to talk about what the true or the real definition of diversity is? Then I would like to share a story.
Sure. So simply put, diversity is something different between you and I. For instance, this conversation, we both approach such knowing what the topic was, but we bring to such different experiences. And it is those experiences that allow us to have an intelligent conversation on the subject or on any subject. And quite frankly, diversity always begins with thought. Thought that, you know, frankly, does not suggest that when the word diversity is dropped, that it's synonymous with African American. Diversity is simply thought. It begins with thought. And for me, it involves organizations, cultures, people, and it includes everything else in between.
Okay, good. So I have an interesting story, and it bounces off of what you just said. Last year, when Top Recruiter, some images and pictures from Top Recruiter were shared out, there was a picture of the whole cast and crew, except for the directing crew and the editing crew. And in this picture included all kinds of people. There was me, a 50-year-old white woman, single mom, right? There was a Cuban-American, there was a lesbian, there was a gay man, there was a Vietnamese individual, there was a single dad, there was a Hispanic individual, there was, you know, and I'm struggling because I don't know how they want to be referred to, right? We talk about that sensitivity issue. And the crew that did the editing and did the directing and the filming of this project were very diverse. The director on the project is black. And there was an angry individual who saw this picture and said, it would be nice, but the director was not in the picture, if you added some diversity to this cast. And I looked at the cast, and not one person was the same. There were two white men in the picture also, so they may have been considered the same, but one was single and living a good life, and the other was married with two kids. So that's diversity right there when you think about it, because they live totally different lives. And so I was frustrated with that because I felt like we have a very diverse crew, right? And especially given that the director was a black man and she was black, the commenter. And it was frustrating to me because I don't see diversity as just black and white. I mean, literally the metaphor of black and white, and also individuals who are black and who are white. So how can we help both sides, white people, to truly understand what diversity means, and also black people that to understand that, and is diversity include more than black people?
Oh, most definitely. And that's why I just said a moment ago that diversity is not synonymous with African American or black. And so you just revealed exactly what I was going to ask you was the commenter, what was the race of the commenter? And I suspect that as it relates to that specific scenario, she was asking for an individual, or she was suggesting that there's no African Americans in that image that you are referring to. And I think that, you know, her comment holds about a percent of validity because there were no African-Americans in that image. But what she needs is an education, or she needed to have a better definition of diversity, and she needed to be honest by applying a better definition of diversity to that image, because there's no way that I could look at that and see all of the different people that you just shared and say that there was a lack of diversity. No, there was just a lack of an African-American.
Right. Okay. All right, good. There was a – how do I jump into this story? Because I wanted to get this story there. Several years ago, the Rodney King riots happened in Southern California. At that time, I was 28 years old, married to a police officer in East L.A., and I had two children. And the morning of the second day of riots, the day before I had stayed glued to the TV, and my husband was on 24-hour call, meaning he had to be ready to go at any time. And the day before he had finished, had done a 14-hour shift, and he was getting ready to go in again. And I had my face glued to the TV, right, all day watching this going on. So my mom lives in Las Vegas, and I woke up that morning and told my husband, I'm going to go stay at mom's. I can't watch this on TV all day, every day again. So please stay safe. I love you, but I need to leave. So I went to the gas station to gas up, and it was like the world slowed completely down. I got out of my car, checked on my girls in the back seat, who were 3 and 5 years old at the time, or two and four at the time. And I was putting gas in my car, and in slow motion, it really completely surreal experience for me. I looked up, and the gentleman putting gas in his car directly in front of me was a black man, and our eyes locked, and we both started crying, you know, and there was just, I'm going to cry talking about it. Sorry. There was just this moment of, I'm not like that, we said to each other. You know, I'm not like that. And we are all human beings. And I will never forget that moment in my life, you know. And it was this connection to another person who I didn't know his name. I didn't know his story. But I wanted him to know that I was not like what he thought white people were like. And he wanted me to know that he was not what black people were, what I thought black people were like, which I didn't. But, you know, there was just this moment of silent communication, and I will never forget that moment.
So let me tell you, let me say this to you: you cannot not communicate, and I can't stress that enough. You cannot not communicate, and you should not. The very same thing that you refer to in Rodney is happening here in Baltimore City. I'll give you a real life example: 2015. That was 1993. We're talking 2015. A friend of mine walked into the office last Tuesday, the day after the riots, not the protests. I want to make that very clear. There's a distinct difference. She walked into her office the day after the riots, and her supervisor said, how could they do that? Why do they act that way? You're not like them. So stop right there. You know, that right there, the you're not like them statement implies all types of reality. Let's be real. She may not be like them. So there's some truth to that. But the bias overweighs that. What does you're not like them mean? And ultimately, when you say them, then how does that impact the way that you look at those individuals, people like who might come into the organization and apply for work, want to take advantage of services that you all have to offer? We might sit next to one another at the station. We could be the two that are pumping gas from as you were in 1993. And she looks across, and I'm standing out the big black truck that I drive, and I have on a pair of blue jeans and a very nice T-shirt, but I don't have on a suit and tie. She might consider me to be them. So it's those biases that we bring to all of these scenarios. And you are right in the exchange that you shared with that young man, being able to communicate in real moment. You all got your message across, and the both of you are better for that.
Yeah, it was an incredible experience, which I will never forget. Torin, I'm going to talk a little bit, and while I talk, I'd like you to move to another location because we're not getting everything, and I want to make sure that we hear everything that you have to say. So when we talk about racial bias and the issues that are out there today, when we talk about what's happened in Baltimore, what happened in Los Angeles in 1993, why does it continue to be an issue? Why is it still prevalent today? Is it because we are just all diverse, we are all individuals that come from a different place, and we just can't possibly let go of those biases? Is it how we are raised? Does it have to do with experiences that we've had? How can we get to a place where we can move forward and away from bias?
So can you hear me right now?
Yes.
Part of how we get to a better place is we have to be honest and have a conversation. You got to think about the fact of, or shall I say, the time of Attorney General Eric Holder, when he said that we were a nation of cowards back in 2009. He may have chosen the wrong words, but the media snatched that phrase and they took him to town on
right.
that. Think about the director of the FBI just this year when he said that we have some work to do, and he delivered that phrase or those words at a speech at Georgetown University. The media excoriated him for using
yeah.
that platform to talk about the things that were happening in Ferguson. You
right.
can, what's his name? Howard Schultz from Starbucks.
Right.
He wanted to have the hashtag race together. We're talking
he wanted
less
to start
than 30,
the conversation.
40 days ago.
Right.
Just wanted to start a conversation, and it may not have been the best time to do it over a latte. You don't have a whole lot of time to talk
right.
about something as serious as this, but
right.
he wanted to use his platform to have a conversation, and the media and the business community took him to town.
Yes.
So the point that I'm trying to make is that whenever we try to have that conversation on a very large level, when we try to use a megaphone that should be used, well, you get beat up for that.
Right.
And
you
so
can't
for a
win
lot
for
of people,
trying.
That's right. So for a lot of people, they're not willing to put themselves out there to try to have this conversation, knowing Tom is going to be just a bucket load of backlash, and perhaps in some ways it falling on deaf ears. But the direct answer is that we have to have the conversation.
That's
and
right.
you and I may not have the larger platform that the Attorney General or the Director of the FBI had, or that Howard Schultz has access to as the CEO of Starbucks, but you and I doing it today and allowing one person at a time to hear this recording, we're doing it the right way. You cannot
right.
be afraid to talk about something that is there. It's here. And no one can deny that. I even heard someone say, you know, last week that white men in America are under assault. So I paused for a moment. I paused, and I'm waiting for quality examples of how that is happening. I didn't necessarily get them, but I didn't also, you know, I didn't walk away from hearing that feeling like, oh, my goodness, this is, you know, we just have to talk about it. Does that,
right.
does that make sense, Rayanne?
Right. Yeah, it does. It does. And I mean, I've actually thought that. I actually would not let my children watch The Simpsons because of how the father was treated and thought of. You know, I feel like in a family, dad should get respect. you know, and when my kids were little, you know, I didn't want, and you as a dad know that, you know, that there was, and there are other shows out there where dad is the idiot, you know, dad's the idiot on the TV show. And, you know, that stuff becomes part of society. Those things, those images become part of thought process. So, and as I asked about racial bias, you interpreted it how you interpret it, because I asked you. So let's flip it a little bit. Is there racial bias toward white people from the black community?
So you have biases for people in reference to, well, first of all, the answer is yes. Absolutely, there are biases from Africa towards others, to include white, Hispanic, Latino, lesbian, gay, transgender, queer. You have biases from all people shared in regards to age, you know, religious, communal,
that's
economic,
right,
educational, territorial, vocational biases. We have more biases than I care to even list. And so for me to, once again, have an honest and genuine conversation with you and to answer that question without saying yes, well, it would be a waste of time.
Right.
I wanted to be transparent and honest, and so absolutely. And do I share some of those biases as it relates to various people, certain instances, different situations, time of the day, where I am? Absolutely. Absolutely,
right.
Absolutely, absolutely. We all do. We just have to have a mechanism within us to say, one, I recognize that this is a bias, and two, it's not something that I'm going to cast over an entire group of people. That is just irresponsible, and it's not productive. But we all bring them to the equation, and we just have to be able to honor, you know, we got to respect that.
Right.
And I respect it. I don't think it's not something that we can legislate or regulate. It's just who we are. It happens. I mean, if I'm running down, you know, I don't know, I can't even give you an example. The point is, if I hold the door open for a woman and I didn't put anything on her except for gender, she's a woman, I would think that she is to say thank you because you held the door open. And if she doesn't hold the door open, of course, in that moment, I'm like, wow, you're not as polite as I would want you to be. I'm not going to walk away from that experience and suggest that all women are less than polite. Does that make sense?
Right, right, right.
There we go. So we have biases. We just got to check them.
That's right. And when we consider everything that's happened, everything that's transpired, I mean, you've got Kent State, you've got the Watts riots, we've got the Rodney King riots, and every event that has been racially charged since them and in between, and the things that are happening today. Does the media hurt or hinder our efforts to heal and move forward? What about politics that become involved in this? How do we decipher what is true that's being published or being shared on the news? Because this is a big question, because I'm on the other side of the country from you, as far away as we can get and still be in the continuous United States, right? And it looked to me, by what the media was showing, that the riots went on for a few days. And you're telling me it was only one day.
If you allow the media, if you allow the media to tell the story of Baltimore last week, you would think that half of our city was on fire.
That's right.
If you allow the media to tell the story of Baltimore's riot from Monday, or for them to talk about the peaceful protests from Saturday, they failed to tell you why the protest turned ugly on Saturday. And some people suggest, and I've heard this from credible people on the ground that are friends of mine, connections of friends of mine, the peaceful protests on Saturday turned ugly because they had revelers and people that were supporting restaurants around the baseball stadium began hurling racial slurs at the protesters, even throwing beer on some of the protesters, and some of the protesters decided that we weren't going to take that, that they weren't going to take that. I'm sorry, because I wasn't there, so I wanted to correct that line. They weren't going to take that. And so the media didn't take the time out to share piece of why the protest turned ugly on Saturday evening. Here's my point. The media is culpable in much of what they do. They find and search for sensationalism, and when they get their finger on that, they, I mean, they press as hard as they possibly can.
Yes, they can do.
Right? You even had yesterday a young man was running in the street and apparently had a gun on him. The gun fell out of his pocket. The gun went off. You had one outlet that said that a young man was shot. You had people in the area telling interviews that the man was shot by the police. And that's a powder keg. And that
sure
is going out across the entire country, and yet nobody was shot. Nobody. No one. So the media and politicians do a terrible job of mending and taking care of, you know, the relationship of building in this country. Terrible.
Right.
I will drop on you that both parties are guilty. I
think of
Lee Atwater from 1981 and the Republican strategy that he proposes. And for the sake of clean radio, I'm not going to repeat his speech, but anyone listening can pull up Lee Atwater's Southern strategy speech from 1981, and that is the playbook right now for Republicans. Terrible job of race relations. And from the Democratic side, they need to grow a spine. They need to be able to stand up and talk about, you know, listen, these things are not right, and we need to address that. You got to call a spade, but because both sides are doing less than genuine work and they are focused more on politics, and the media is focused more on sensationalism, we have what we have. And so it takes thoughtful. Go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead. Thoughtful?
Well, I was just going to say it just takes thoughtful and even-keeled individuals to try to have sensible conversations like you and I are having right now. And, and I think that we will make far more progress.
And that's why I started this show off with the quote from, you know, Benjamin Franklin, quarrels never could last long if on one side only lay the wrong, right? If there's only one, if only one side is wrong, it can be discovered pretty quickly and solved. But there are wrongs on both sides of any story, whether it's the media and those who view the media, the politicians and those who create the laws and those who benefit from the laws and who vote the politicians in, right? And when we talk about laws that protect bias, right? There have been laws in place that not protect bias, but protect against bias, whether it's racial or age, you know, in any type of bias that is out there. Why don't we talk more about what is the right thing to do, not what's the law, right? I mean, I look at life as I rely a lot on the universal code of ethics. It's part of I feel like it's almost part of my genetic makeup. You know, I wouldn't push an old lady down or trip her, right? Because it's just not the right thing to do. So why do we not fall back on that universal code of morals or honor or ethics? Why do we fall on, well, it's the law instead of it's the right thing to do?
You know, I don't know how to answer that. I'm really not. I'm challenged on on the answer to that why. And I think that that's a very good question. But I do want to pick up on something you just said. We focus so much on the problem and not the solution. And if you recall last year, a lot of the tech stalwarts out west released their diversity numbers.
Right.
And in regards to diversity, they didn't necessarily specify in all cases how they defined diversity, but in general, they had less than favorable diversity numbers. And so for a period of 12, 13, 14 months, that's what we saw, drips and drips and drips of less than desirable diversity numbers. And let me be the one to tell you that we are doing a film, a documentary on the impact of diversity, and I have reached out to so many of these companies, and the first thing that I tell them is that we will not discuss your diversity numbers. That's not the purpose of the film. The purpose is for us to capture best practices and how to move forward. I think we've had enough of the conversation of what's wrong. Let's just try to tap into what's right, what's working, what we've tried.
How do we move forward?
Work, but how do we move forward? And so that's not skirting the conversation. It's just trying to move the meter of progress. And I don't know that enough people, as you say, just dial into what intrinsically we know is right. It just doesn't make sense to trip an old lady down the steps. Like, you don't need a rule. You don't need a law. You don't need a quota. You don't need anything. You just need to know that intrinsically it doesn't, it's just not the right thing to do. And I don't know what it's going to take to get more people, all people to tap into that. That's really what we want. We really would want all people to just tap into a moral compass. But unfortunately, Rayanne, so many people have broken moral compasses. And you know, and some of those people are in positions of authority. And when I say authority, you know, you have authority in going into a grocery store and buying a pack of gum. So when I say authority, everybody has a position in which they have some level of authority. I just wish all people would tap into their moral compass.
Thank you, Torin. That is a statement. The question that I've wondered for a long time. I'm glad that I've been able to sit down with you and ask that question and talk more about it. I want to ask that of every guest that I have throughout this series is, why can't we just see what's right and what's wrong? So moving forward, are you familiar with the story of The Fox and the Hound? I sent you a link. This is a movie, a Disney movie from many, many, many years ago, and it tells the story of a fox and a hound when they were young and how they played together and didn't even consider that they were different, right? And then all of a sudden they meet again as an adult fox, an adult hound, and the fox is being chased by the hound. Why does it seem, you know, they were unlikely friends and they were able to have a moment of moving past what their lot in life, where they were dropped in to life? You know, it's the fox is supposed to be chased by the hound. But how can we move forward? I think talking about it, you and I talking about it here, but let's talk about what you launched after the events in Baltimore. I know you can't talk too much about it because it's still in the works, but can you tell us a little bit about what you'd like to see happen in Baltimore?
Absolutely. So what I want to do is I like to stay in my lane, and after watching the news on Monday evening and the riots and all of the things that happened, and you know, people thinking that it was the young people that were doing much of that work. When you woke up the next day, you listened to the various stories on the street. I was in the community and talking to people, and so I made it my business to rally the tech community, and I reached out to about 20 individuals. 16 to 20 individuals, high-powered individuals that I know in various aspects of the tech community, whether they be investors, whether they come from the legal side, whether they are developers, a variety of people, incubator directors. I reached out to 20 or so personalities and said the tech community must make a statement. And that statement has to be very loud and with some level of authority as to what we plan to do to have a better Baltimore, a much better Baltimore. And out of the pain should come some level of progress and triumph, and that is what we are pursuing. And so I am bringing together a large group of tech people. We are having our first meeting on next week, and trust me when I tell you, the response has been overwhelming. And the individuals are dropping emails. They are dropping emails with suggestions and thoughts and observations. And I think that we are going to have a very fruitful discussion. So what I would say to you is stand by, you know, and just look, you know, 4-6 months from now, you are going to see some very different things happening, not just for that part of Baltimore, but for all of Baltimore. And I suspect that if it goes the way that I'm hoping that it will go, that we will have an impact on our region as well.
Well, I'm sure nationally, too. I mean, the tech community is all borders, all state borders, we know internet is everywhere, so you can't get away from that. And I appreciate your efforts there, and I look forward to hearing more. Hopefully we can have you back on the show in 6 months, and you can give us an update and make sure that we know, hey, this is how we started it. You can start something like this in your own community. That's where it has to start. It has to start with two people, you and I, maybe, having a conversation here and not being afraid to ask the questions that nobody wants to ask, you know, to talk, have an open conversation about how can I help? How can I be different? How can I contribute? How can I change? What can I do differently?
That's right.
So
that's right.
It's the time has gone so quickly, so I want to get a couple of last questions in here. When considering your own future, Torin, you as a service provider, you've had a successful solo business for many years. So when you consider yourself as a practitioner and what you provide to your clients, can you give us three key things that you do to make sure that you are doing your job the best way possible?
So, Rayanne, thank you again for having me. I apologize for the dropping of
That's
calls
okay.
and some of the background noise. But let me just tell you that for me, the three things are very quick. I perform a thorough discovery minus a job description. In 17 years, I've never asked a client for a job description. If they share it, that's fine. But what I want is to hear from them. I need to know that you know what you need inside of your organization. I don't need to read a piece of paper. I want to hear it from you, because ultimately you are going to measure an individual through your interactions. You're not going to necessarily measure them through a job description. Number two, I just work to continue to deliver quality over quantity. I've never been the guy to send out, 20 resumes for one position. If I can't get it right in 3 or 4 resumes, then I don't need to be recruiting. That's just the way
that's right.
I look at it. And then number three, and I'm trying to evolve from a vision standpoint. I'm trying to evolve the Torin Ellis brand to become more of a hybrid firm. I want our firm to be seen as brand ambassadors and recruiters. I want our brand to be seen as extensions of your brand, where we can handle your social media, your marketing, all of the things that are necessary around the attraction of talent, filling up your pipeline, ultimately hiring better employees, reducing attrition, increasing productivity. That's the type of recruiting firm that I want to be. I've done transactional recruitment for 17 years, do it, love it, can do it in my sleep. But I want to challenge myself to become more of a trusted advisor. And in order to do that, we got to take on some different tasks that are beyond just grabbing another requisition. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Any last words of wisdom you can share with us?
Any organization that's serious about diversity, they need a really strong initiative. They need to tie that into the business case that answers the question, why does this make sense? And it's got to have direction from leadership or founder of the organization. Without those three components, it's just going to be nothing more than another press release or, window dressing. It demands that people are very serious about connecting the dot of why do we do this and what's the impact going to be. I want organizations to be thoughtful and willing to explore and even push the boundaries past those of what they used to do. I want them to believe that through their effort, you can truly have a successful diversity initiative inside of any sized organization.
Thank you so much, Torin. Now we have approached the end of the show, and I always ask these four fave questions. What's your favorite food?
Tacos.
Tacos. Is there a great place to go in Baltimore? Or do you make them yourself?
Well, I can make them, and there are a few great places to go, but I just love tacos from my days of living down in Texas, and quite frankly, it was a high school treat every Friday. Me and my best friend would have tacos before we went to the basketball game or the football game.
Oh.
So I love tacos. I love tacos.
It's attached to a memory as well. That's wonderful.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Your favorite book?
48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene.
Ah, well, I see, this is why I ask these questions, because I learned so much. 48 Laws of Power?
That's right.
Is that
by
correct?
Howard.
All right.
I'm sorry, by Robert Greene with an E on the end.
Mm-hmm. Great. I will look that up. Your favorite place on earth? This could be, and I always qualify this with, it could be a place in your home, a room in your home. It could be a park close by. It could be a remote location. Anything.
So, yeah, my favorite place is Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I love my grandmother, and anytime I can be with grandma, that's exactly where I want to be.
That's wonderful. And your favorite thing to do?
I don't get to do it as often as I'd like, but I'm a drummer, and when I was growing up, I played the drums in my church. Everything that I've done, Rayanne, has been self-taught, to include recruitment today. And I taught myself how to play the drums and was pretty good at it. So my favorite thing is walking around the house, headphones on, great tune
That's
in
awesome.
My ear, and I'm banging on the walls, or the rail of the steps as I just love percussion. So that's my favorite thing.
Love that. Thank you, Torin, so much for being my guest. We did have a couple of callers on hold, but I know that you have to jump to a panel discussion that continues.
Try to get them.
Okay, let's see.
A couple more minutes.
All right, I'm opening the mic for, let's see, I got area code 314.
You know, I was listening to I'm living here close to Ferguson, here in the St. Louis area.
Hi. Thank you for calling.
Yes, my name is Pianchi, and I heard you mention about the biases. And one of the problems we have in a community like Ferguson is that the public service job, because most everything else is small businesses, most of the white businesses long since moved, but the public service jobs are still controlled by the remnants of the whites that used to be there. And they utilize the good old boy system in their hiring. Therefore, you have a position like what you have out of 53 police officers, only two are black. And what we're trying to do, and what another city have done not too far from Jennings dissolved their police force, temporarily hired the county to take care of their policing, and they're in an expedient manner trying to train locals so that they can have, you know, be working in those capacities, because they live there and they pay for that. And we see this type of good old boy system going on in, you know, in different aspects. You had a bridge project, a construction project, where the local African-American employees, they weren't being hired, even though they were drug tested and qualified. So I wonder, how do you get rid of that bias? Because you're talking about money, you're talking about wages, salary,
right,
benefits, and pensions. So whites do not give up that very easy unless you resort to some drastic things like having Al Sharpton come in and we shut down
right.
the interstate highway and say, this is not going to happen when you go through here.
Well, I think it has to start with us having conversations like this. I don't know that we can change, the way it's always been without talking about it and exposing. I mean, you calling in and telling us about this is important. Right? We need to expose that this is going on. Torin, do you have anything to add?
Absolutely. Just a quick response. You know, part of the challenge in biases is the shift, the demographic shift that's taking place. And those that are in power, for the most part, are white Americans, Caucasian Americans. And you got to be very honest about that. And
right.
so because we know that the racial shift is taking place and that they're, you know, dominance in terms of numbers is slowly waning, and by 2030 will be less, by 2050 will be no more. They definitely are doing the things that they can to hold on to power, whether it be voting rights, whether it be hiring practices. And so to you, my dear friend in Ferguson, it's just a matter of you all working all of the levers that are important: voting, participating, community activism, showing up prepared. Let me make sure I stress that. Showing up prepared. So for those that are going for work, you, like you said, passing the background check, all of those things, we got to do them and we can't get tired of doing them.
That's right. So with that, thank you, Bianchi, for calling. We really appreciate you calling in. I'm going to let Torin go and thank him again for joining us today. It has been an absolute pleasure, Torin, to have you here on HR Latte. Thanks for kicking off the series with me. I hope that you will come back on the last show in the series, and we can talk about the things that have been discovered throughout the month and how things are going in Baltimore.
I'd enjoy that. Thank you ever so much. Enjoy your day.
Thanks, folks. Please join us again on Thursday. I'll be continuing the series on diversity in the workforce. Thursday, I'll be talking with Mark Miller, and we'll be discussing ageism. So we're not just talking about racial bias in this series. We're talking about all the biases that exist out there when it comes to hiring and managing talent. Thanks again for joining me today on HR Latte.